Good morning. It's wonderful. Good morning. It's wonderful to see you all this morning. A special welcome to those of you who are visiting us for the first time. We're glad that you're here, and we hope that you find Unity Church to be a place which helps you to find and keep your balance, a place which nourishes you and inspires you to lead a loving life of integrity, service, and joy. After this morning's service, you're invited to join us for refreshments and fellowship in the parish hall. If you're visiting, please stop by the welcome table. We'd love to welcome you into our community and answer any questions you might have. After the service, you can also visit the Anderson Library and the Children's Library, which are both located upstairs on the Elliott Wing. Inside your order of worship, you'll see an insert, This Week at Unity, which serves as a roadmap to deeper involvement in the church. Next Sunday, the Reverend Ann Romanzik will lead the service, entitled The Elder Care Journey. Services are at 10 o'clock. At the conclusion of today's service, Duncan and I would love to greet you out there at the Portland Avenue doors. Once again, I welcome all of you to Unity Church. Let us give thanks for June. This time of flowers and fireflies and weddings and thunderstorms. This time when cups are full, and even though we ache, there's always room for a little more. More life, more love, more tears. More could-be's and not so many should-haves. More beginnings, more endings. Let us give thanks for June. Come, let us worship together. Let's read together the unison reading. I thank you, God, for most this amazing day, for the leaping, greenly spirits of trees and a blue, true dream of sky, and for everything which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes. I, who have died, am alive again today, and this is the sun's birthday. This is the birthday of life and of love and wings, and of the gay, great, happening, illimitably earth. How should tasting, touching, hearing, seeing, breathing any, lifted from the know of all nothing, human merely being doubt, unimaginable you. Now the ears of my ears awake, and now the eyes of my eyes are opened. You may be seated.
Every Sunday when we gather, we set aside time to expand the caring ministry of this congregation. Together, we recognize the cycle of life and death, the circle of love, compassion, and witness that permeates this sacred place. Our hearts are with all those who live with grief or chronic pain, for illnesses seen and unseen, those who live with addiction, those who live with mental illness, those who care for family members in ill health, and those who knowingly face their final days. This morning, we celebrate the life and mourn the death of Shirley Youngbloom. Shirley was Bernice Hansen's youngest sister. She had a severe heart attack last summer and was recently admitted to the hospital where she died. We hold in our embrace this morning Paul Jones, the father of Margaret Jones, who died on Tuesday, June 19th. Paul is also the father-in-law of Jeff Riesberg and grandfather of Patrick and Joey Riesberg. This morning is also a time for joy. We celebrate the 30th wedding anniversary of Molly and Ed Cavan, who were married in this place on June 24th, 1977. Our well wishes go to our Unity Church friends who are in Portland, Oregon, attending the UEOA General Assembly, and particularly to Carrie Meyer, Unity Church Religious Education Director, who was honored Friday night in Portland as the outstanding UU religious educator in the nation. May our compassion and care extend beyond these walls to creation itself and to Mother Earth, which sustains us all. And may we stand in compassionate solidarity with our neighbors all around the world who suffer in the midst of habitual violence. May they and we be instruments of lasting peace. I now invite you to share the names of those people you would like to celebrate, memorialize, or hold in the embrace of this community. For the names which have been spoken and the names which remain in the silent sanctuary of our hearts, may we be forever grateful for the lives that have touched ours. Now a moment of prayer. Mysterious presence, source of all, bringer of light and dark, good and bad, of happiness and sadness, we acknowledge your presence within us, among us, and beyond us this day. May your spirit inspire us to reach as fully as possible a life of usefulness, caring, and meaning, and in your light encourage us to turn away from those things which beguile but do not satisfy, the pursuit of sterile luxury, the narrow cultivation of ego, the practice of pride and unwarranted arrogance. Help us to be always aware that there are miracles around us on every hand, even in a blade of grass, more wondrous than anything which the human mind has conjured up as miracle. Help us to keep in mind that there are two landscapes to inspire us: the universe without, with all its beauty and beckoning mysteries, and the other landscape which resides in the faces and minds of those around us whom we cherish and through which alone our lives can achieve true meaning. May we find through them the courage to carry us through the difficult and discouraging times which beset us all.
Thank you.
First reading this morning is from the writings of Albert Einstein. Try and penetrate with our limited means the secrets of nature, and you will find that behind all the discernible laws and connections, there remains something subtle, intangible, and inexplicable. Veneration for this force beyond anything that we can comprehend is my religion. To that extent, I am, in fact, religious.
And this from the poet Rumi. These forms we seem to be are cups floating in an ocean of living consciousness. They fill and sink without leaving an arc of bubbles or any goodbye spray. What we are is that ocean, too near to see, though we swim in it and drink it in. Don't be a cup with a dry rim, or someone who rides all night and never knows the horse beneath his thighs, the surging that carries him along.
More years ago than I care to think about, the Reverend Arthur Foote preached a remarkable series of sermons on Unitarian poets, some of which you have heard this morning in our hymns, including, as well as I remember, not only Walt Whitman, but Robert Frost, E.E. Cummings, possibly Wallace Stevens, and others whom I can no longer remember. Typical of the Reverend Foote, these sermons had an elegance and depth which I cannot hope to follow, but I do feel perhaps Walt Whitman is worth another look. So, what have you to tell us, Walt Whitman? Does your barbaric yawp still echo over the roofs of the world? Do you still tread the open road? Through you, can we still hear America singing? What shall we say out of our modern times, Walt Whitman? Whitman was born in 1819 in rural Long Island, an area which inspired him all of his life. His father was a carpenter and his mother, of Dutch stock, was a remarkable woman who had a great influence on Whitman. In one of his poems, he describes her as perfect. The family shortly moved to Brooklyn, where the young Whitman ceased school at the age of 11 and went into the printing business as an apprentice, where he worked as a printer, compositor, and writer. In 1846, he became the editor of the Brooklyn Eagle, a job which he held only briefly because he was fired in 1848 for being too vocal about his free soil beliefs. He shortly undertook a journey down to New Orleans, where again he had a brief stint as the editor of the New Orleans Crescent. He lasted a year, then returned to his favorite love, New York. But he was fascinated by the sights and sounds around him. And for the next 5 years, he appears to have sort of loafed and invited his soul. He began to read widely, and his poems show the result in the eclecticism of his vocabulary. He hurled himself into the cultural life of the city. He was a great patron of the stage and of musical events, and during this time, formerly something of a dandy, he now affected a rough appearance, and a favorite portrait of him shows him dressed in pants and a loose shirt unbuttoned at the neck with a broad-brimmed hat placed rakishly on his head. In 1855, he produced the work that was to engage him the rest of his life, Leaves of Grass. It was met with something less than an enthusiastic response from the public, although Emerson and some other discriminating types praised it. Emerson went the length of sending a fulsome letter of congratulation to Whitman. Said he, "I find incomparable things said incomparably well." This was to be expected since Emerson had called for a true American literature, both in his Divinity School address, "Too long have we followed the courtly muses of Europe," and his essay, "The Poet," which was a plea for an American poet to come forward to celebrate the emerging nation. It is obvious from Whitman's poetry that he in fact conceived as his duty to perform the task together with his conviction that such poets were necessary to lead the nation in the direction it should go. At the beginning of the Civil War, he found himself in Washington, and the war years there were probably the most important years of his life. He spent his time in the hospitals doing what he could for the wounded and dying of both armies, and his experiences can be followed in his collection of poems under the title Drum Taps, later incorporated in later editions of The Leaves of Grass. After the war was over, he got himself employed in the Bureau of Indian Affairs, only to be fired because they found his poetry to be immoral. He was shortly installed in a clerkship in the Department of Justice, where he served until 1873, when he suffered a crippling stroke. He found it necessary to retire to Camden, where he lived out the rest of his life, depending on the largesse of friends such as Mark Twain, Henry James, and R.L. Stevenson. He continued to write poetry and was lucky enough to have his seventh edition of Leaves of Grass banned in Boston, being indecent. He died in 1892, more admired abroad than in the United States. So, who are you, Walt Whitman? Let's go explore it, I with thee and thou with me. Walt Whitman, a cosmos, a Manhattan, the sun, turbulent, fleshy, sensual, eating, drinking, and breeding, no sentimentalist, no stander above men and women or apart from them. And where are you headed, Walt Whitman? Afoot and lighthearted I take to the open road, healthy, free, the world before me. Henceforth I ask not good fortune. I myself am good fortune. Strong and content, I travel the open road. I inhale great drafts of space. The east and west are mine, and the north and south are mine. Whoever you are, come travel with me. However sweet these laid-up stores, however convenient this dwelling, we cannot remain here. Forward, after the great companions, and to belong to them, they too are on the road. To know the universe itself as a road, as many roads, as roads for traveling souls. You profess to be a poet of everyone. You have used the words en masse. So what about women, Walt Whitman? I am the poet of the women, the same as the man. And I say it is as great to be a woman, the same as the man, and I say there's nothing greater than the mother of men. And this brings us to the matter of sex, something not much discussed in their time, so what of it? I sing the body electric. This is the female form, a divine nimbus from it, from head to foot. It attracts with fierce, undeniable attraction. I am drawn by its breath as if I were no more than a helpless vapor. All falls aside but myself and it. Books, art, religion, time, the visible and solid earth, and what was expected of heaven or feared of hell are now consumed. Mad filaments, ungovernable shoots play out of it. The response likewise ungovernable. Hair, bosom, hips, bend of legs, negligent falling of hands, all diffused. Mine too diffused. Ebb stung by the flow, and stung flow by the ebb. Love flesh swelling and deliciously aching. Limitless limpid jets of love, hot and enormous. Quivering jelly of love, white blow and delirious juice. Bridegroom night of love working surely and softly into the prostrate dawn. The man's body is sacred and the woman's body is sacred. Wow. Even in an age of gangsta rap, that ought to make the steam come out of your ears. Some hostile commentator once commented that Whitman was overly concerned with genital fittings and seminal jettings. And you can see why conscientious parents were eager to keep this sort of stuff out of the hands of their children and why he would be banned in Boston. And what of miracles, Walt Whitman? I believe a leaf of grass is no less than the journey work of the stars, and the pismire is equally perfect, and a grain of sand, and the egg of the wren, and a tree toad is a chef d'oeuvre of the highest, and a running blackberry would adorn the parlors of heaven, and the narrowest hinge in my hand puts all to scorn all machinery, and the cow, crunching with depressed head, surpasses any statue, and a mouse is miracle enough to stagger sextillions of infidels. So how do you see the task of the poet, then? Away with old romance. Away with novels, plots, and plays of foreign courts. Away with love verses sugared in rhyme, the intrigues, amours of idlers, fitted only for banquets of the night where dancers to late music slide, the unhealthy pleasures, the extravagant dissipations of the few. Then I chant it for thee, I glorify thee above all, I bring thee a song, excuse me, I say I bring thee a muse today here, all occupations broad and close, toil, healthy toil and sweat, away with romance. What about modern materialism? The place where the great city stands is not the place of stretched wharves, docks, manufacturers, deposits of products merely, nor the place of ceaseless salutes of newcomers or the anchor lifting of the departing, nor the place of the tallest buildings or shops selling goods from the rest of the earth, nor the place of the most numerous population. Where the city stands were the broadest breed of orators and bards, where no monuments exist to heroes but in the common words and deeds, where thrift is in its place and prudence in its place, where the men and women think lightly of the laws, where the slave ceases and the master of slaves ceases, where the populace rise at once against the never-ending audacity of elected persons, where outside authority enters after the precedence of inside authority, where the citizen is always the head and ideal and president, mayor, governor, and whatnot are agents for pay, where children are taught to be laws to themselves and to depend on themselves, where speculations on the soul are encouraged, where women walk in public processions in the streets the same as the men, where they enter the public assembly and take places the same as the men, where the city of the faithfulest friends stands, where the city of the cleanliness of the sexes stands, there the great city stands. Close association with death was an important part of your life, Walt Whitman. So what do you have to say about that? Come, lovely and soothing death, undulate around the world, serenely arriving in the day, in the night, to all, to each, sooner or later, delicate death. Praised be the fathomless universe for life and joy, and for objects and knowledge curious, and for love, sweet love, but praise, 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 for sure and finding arms of cool enfolding death. Dark mother, always gliding near with soft feet, have none chanted for thee a chant of full welcome? Then I chant it for thee. I glorify thee above all. I bring thee a song that when thou must indeed come, come unfalteringly. So now let us strike a line under all of that and see what it adds up to. It should be apparent, I think, that Walt was operating in a society and time greatly different from our own. It was a time when the individual was the center of all thought, the age of the autonomous person who was the center of the thinking of Emerson and Thoreau, for instance. It was a time when, as he says, the ideal was that children were taught to be a law to themselves and to depend on themselves. There is no doubt that the idea of the autonomous individual is no longer current in our society. Walt was also very obviously writing in a time of great optimism, whereas in our present day it is difficult, I believe, to regard the future with unbounded enthusiasm. Walt saw in science the promise of material improvement. He wrote a laudatory poem to a locomotive and cited with strong approval the laying of the transatlantic cable. In contrast, at this time, it seems to me that many of us regard material advances as a two-edged sword. All advances seem to have a downside, nuclear energy, for example. While he was, therefore, an obvious child of his time, in many ways, he also was in advance of it. One can cite here his attitude toward women and the underprivileged, and even by pretty clear implication, tolerance of gays and lesbians. He was warmly persuaded of the virtues of democracy while at the same time endorsing a healthy spirit of distrust toward governmental authority, urging us to beware of the never-ending audacity of elected persons. I like that. Do we have any examples of it? And while he espoused individualism, I sing myself. He also seeks to embody the totality of mankind, but utter the word en masse, he says. And this thought is carried out in several of his longer poems, and he urges us to constantly move forward and explore. Some wag once said that Emerson wanted to reform the world, Thoreau wanted to retreat from it, but Whitman wanted to throw himself into it. While Whitman's work was praised by some in this country, it received a greater reception abroad, but it seems to me that Whitman was the victim of that old syndrome of peaking too early, or the phenomenon of the avant-garde, which becomes passé. And so we are led to the question of what is left? What of value is there in these poems for another time? Can we derive any useful insights or is all now lost and should be turned to more modern poets, T.S. Eliot, perhaps, or someone even more current? What is the ambience of the time into which we are seeking to find relevance for Whitman? There are many ways to characterize the zeitgeist, depending upon one's individual point of view. But for a curmudgeon, probably the best way to characterize the time is to say it is a time of entitlements. Somebody calculated that this time in our history, something like 70% of the population find themselves to be in a deserving class. I myself have characterized the body politic as like a large carcass lying out on the African plain, with all the predators and carrion eaters circling around it, each seeking to get its share, a figure probably overdrawn, but nonetheless helpful, I hope. We once had a common vision, which was the American dream, the simple idea that every generation would be better off, and so happier than the previous one. So as we emerge from the magnificent triumph of the Second World War, and as a period of stability and economic boom set in, it was possible to see the American dream coming true. And not just coming true, but promising even more. Not only would succeeding generations be better off, but the nation's chronic problems would be solved and everybody would be happy. And the American dream became the American fantasy, the promise of a world in which we are all entitled to be safe, prosperous, and happy. And so even as we were seeking to make war on poverty and providing Medicare and a Civil Rights Act, the mirror was held up to us, and the fatuity of the American fantasy was brought home to us. Yet we feel ourselves entitled to a happy and prosperous life with a high material standard of living. Now, for the first time in American history, this promise no longer holds. We of the older generation can no longer feel that our children and grandchildren will live lives of greater material prosperity than we do, and we can easily see the reasons why. In future, the costs of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, subsidized health care for all, the charges against income to provide an adequate retirement, and the ever-increasing costs of necessary education for children will be charges against disposable income to a much greater extent than now. So let us turn to Walt. It is clear from his poetry, and even some of the passages which I have recited, that he did not value highly wealth and power, but on the other hand, set highest value on human values. The great city, as he saw it, was not the place of stretched wharves, docks, manufactures, deposits of produce merely. It's the place where true human values are exalted, as we have already seen. This point of view is apparently applicable to a society which is probably going to undergo a diminution of its material standard of living. It is to be emphasized that such diminution does not necessarily imply less happiness. Studies tend to show that people with less prove out to be no less happy than those with much. The New Yorker recently published a cartoon of a tycoon standing in his posh office talking on the telephone and saying, "I've spent so much time with my family recently that I have begun to lose sight of what really matters." Indicative, perhaps, of something chronic here. Perhaps we should take this as it is to mean, as it is meant to be taken, I think, as a commentary on our society of today. Whitman was pretty definite about what really matters, and so is a helpful antidote to that all too prevalent point of view. Those of us who are of a certain age can remember that as we emerged from World War II, the country felt a surge of optimism. It was thought that, by golly, we could do just about anything if we put our minds and hands to it. And optimism was pretty much justified, and it is my curmudgeonly point of view that it still is. And that optimism was justified, but somehow we seem to be going through a lack of confidence. In time past, we heard with pride about the American century, but now we see constant references to the Chinese century and stand in awe at the rapid advance of a nation four times our size and population. Constant references are made to the decline of the Roman Empire as it collapsed amid the sybaritic indulgences of the traditional Roman leadership. And parallels are found between the demands to withdraw the legions from the further regions of the empire and the demands that our fire-flying forces be rotated home. And other parallels come to mind also, as you're well aware. Various polls over the years have registered an ever-declining public confidence in our government and in other powerful segments of the body politic. To read Walt's poetry is to reaffirm the necessary move forward and confidently. To not rest here, typical line says. However sheltered this port, however calm these waters, we must not anchor here. Forward, after the great companions. If you wish to review that, you may look at responsive reading number 645. For those who would wish to burnish their beliefs or refurbish their views, we should also be aware of his Unitarianism. His work is shot through with the spirit of Unitarianism as I understand it. One example is in the lines I read earlier on, in which he points out, a mouse is a miracle enough to stagger sextillions of infidels. 72 virgins, anyone? In another place, he says, we consider Bibles and religions divine. I do not say they are not divine. I say they have all grown out of you and may grow out of you still. This quotation is part of a remarkable passage well worth reading and pondering, found at number 659 in our hymn book. His views are remarkably consistent with our present-day standards. His embrace of all people everywhere as equals, for instance, is completely compatible with the opening words of our creed in the front of the hymn book about the inherent worth of every person and justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. This statement could be taken directly out of his verse. And last, he was an enthusiastic proponent of democracy, a word which constantly appears throughout his verse and his prose writings as well, and of American exceptionalism. He foresaw the United States leading the world to democratic government, provided that the country realized its exceptionalism through the leadership of an intellectual elite of writers, poets, thinkers, musicians, and other similar types. He collectively refers to these as bards. However, as he viewed society in the United States as it appeared in the time after the Civil War, he found it in parlous shape. He says, never was there perhaps more hollowness at heart than at present, than here in the United States. Genuine belief seems to have left us. The spectacle is appalling. We live in an atmosphere of hypocrisy throughout. The men believe not in the women, nor the women in the men. A scornful superciliousness rules in literature. The aim of all the literateurs is to find something to make fun of. A lot of churches, sects, and so on, the most dismal phantasms I know, usurp the name of religion. From deceit in the spirit, the mother of all false deeds, the offspring is already incalculable. The depravity of the business classes of our country is not less than has been supposed, but infinitely greater. The official services of America, national, state, municipal, in all their branches and departments except the judiciary, are saturated with corruption, bribery, falsehood, maladministration. The cities reek with respectable as much as non-respectable robbery and scoundrelism. The sole object is, by any means, pecuniary gain. The best class we show is but a mob of fashionably dressed speculators and vulgarisms. If that sounds familiar, Mr. Trump, it certainly ought to be. And hail to you, Paris Hilton. If it is the task of the bards to rescue the country from these besetting ills and to rescue it from a race to the bottom and give it direction and standards worthy of the great nation we are, then so it is to this task that I believe we ought to charge ourselves. Here is the field before us. Bequeathed to us by 40 years or more of corrosive erosion of our most formative myths and symbols. And these things we, the bards, must resupply that we may truly try to fulfill the vision and promise with which we started of a city on the hill, a beacon and inspiration to all peoples. Therefore, I give you Walt Whitman, Unitarian poet, and still, I would argue, relevant for us and a challenge for us too. May it be so.